Thank you, Thomas. And I want to really thank you and thank Hugues for this invitation. The Journée François Jacob are always really nice. Okay, so for today, the mathematical beauty I would like to talk to you about is the one that we wonder at in my lab, which is that of natural patterns, meaning the visible order in the spatial organization of characters, and that can be either across across the surface of an individual. For example, this fish has these geometrical stripes, or this giraffe has pigmented spots. But then these patterns can also be observed at a whole population scale, such as these migrating herds that create dotted arrays or even virtual curves. And we can also see patterns at the subcellular or cellular scale. And there are many different geometries, from fractals to network dendrites and so on. So I think these few pictures show you how extremely diverse the geometry of these natural patterns can be. Yet, if we choose just one group, for example, squirrels, what we can see is trends in these phenotypes. Because if a squirrel has a pattern, it will always be stripes, and these stripes will always be longitudinal, so oriented from the head to the tail. So there is a lot of diversity in patterns, but also trends. And actually, within species, patterns can be produced with meticulous fidelity and precision. So there is this very typical phenotypic landscape of patterns. On the one hand, huge diversity, and on the other hand, overall trends. And this is rooted in the mechanisms of pattern formation. So initially, a patterning system is a priori homogeneous. So for example, this is a developmental tissue. At one point, it will acquire or generate spatial reference, and elements of this system, such as cells here in black, will respond to this positional information. And after a few steps of differentiation, this will give rise to a visible pattern. And there's two main mechanisms that have been described to explain pattern formation, which we've actually heard about today in several talks. The first one is called instruction. In this case, positional information is provided by an external signal, so there is a source external to the developing tissue that will create a gradient of information. And cells will respond according to their position in this gradient. So for example, if a cell is close to the source, it will become blue, and if it's far away from the source, it will become red. And this will give rise to the formation of a given pattern. So this has been deemed the French frog problem by Lewis Wolpert in the 70s. Since it's been confirmed biologically with the identification of morphogens, molecules that diffuse in gradients within tissues and can trigger differential cell fates, and that have been involved in the instruction of different structures, such as the anterior-posterior gradients, segments in the Drosophila blastoderm, the digits, or different parts of the developing brain. The second big mechanism of pattern formation is so-called self-organization. In this case, the tissue has two initial properties of local interaction and lateral inhibition. And when the tissue has these properties, it may stabilize initial fluctuations in different locations. This will be amplified through time, eventually giving rise to a pattern. And this is a mechanism that has been described by Alan Turing in 52 with this very famous Turing model. Since his equations have been used in numerical simulations, that with some parameters can create these visible patterns. And what's really cool is to see that these visible patterns mimic some patterns that we can see in nature. So self-organization and instruction today are really thought to be involved in nature in the formation of natural patterns. What is less known, though, is how these two mechanisms interact, what is their hierarchy, and most importantly, what type of molecules or factors underlie these mechanisms in vivo, such that they can produce this phenotypic landscape characterized by variation, but also within species fidelity. And so to answer this question, in my lab, we take advantage of the plumage pattern in birds. It is composed of two elements. On the one hand, you have the color pattern, so the spatial distribution of pigments, as seen here on this zebra finch. We also work on color pattern in the lab, but I won't talk about it today, and focus only on the spatial distribution of feathers. So I don't know if you were aware that a bird is not covered by feathers. Feathers are actually restricted to these thin areas. They are implanted in these areas called tracts, separated by glabrous regions that are thought to allow steric space necessary to fly. And so if we zoom in one of these tracts, you can see that the precursors of feather follicles, called primordia, are arranged in these geometries, and they form actually a very typical dotted arrays. And these have been studies pretty broadly, and a lot of different studies predicted through mathematical modeling that this type of dotted array arises through self-organization. So the first thing that we did was to try and describe natural variation in this self-organizing system. And so for this, we chose different species of birds, representative of the whole avian phylogeny. So here you have the emu and the ostrich, together representing the most ancestral clade of flightless birds. The chicken and the quail that are used in most developmental avian studies, that represent the second major clade of bird, also containing the geese and ducks. And then the zebra finch and the penguin that we chose to represent the third and most abundant clade of bird called Neoeves. The zebra finch is a passerine bird. Passerines are extremely common. And the gentoo penguin, we chose this guy because not only is it part of this species-rich group, but also, much like the emu and the ostrich, it is devoid of flight abilities. So let's look at first the chicken and the quail. And in these guys, we describe the timely dynamics of the emergence in the embryo of the primordia array. And we did that by performing stains for beta-catenin, which is a part of the wind signaling pathway, and that has been shown to stain areas competent to form primordia. And you see, so here this is a quail embryo. Here you'd have the head, here the wings, and here the legs. And so beta-catenin will mark these areas of competence with these two longitudinal lines that will very quickly form a primordia row. And then one by one, further rows will be added from the medial part of the embryo to the lateral part of the embryo until the whole tract is completed. So during development, you have a medial to lateral wave of anteroposterior row formation. In the finch, it is very similar. The initial conditions are a bit different, but you also have this medial to lateral wave of primordial emergence that ends up with a bit of a thinner tract. So in these three species, there is a clear wave, morphogenetic wave of primordial emergence. However, in the emu and in the ostrich, initially beta-catenin is expressed in these wider areas, and we could not distinguish any clear, timely wave. Actually, all primordia emerge at once, simultaneously, in a spatially random fashion. So no wave in these species. And more surprisingly, in the gentoo penguin, which is, however, closer to the finch, the beta-catenin is also expressed in these wider areas, within which primordia emerge all at once, in a very peculiar geometry on which I'll come back in a second. So in the penguin, there is no wave either. So that's pretty simple description work, allowing us to show that there is natural variation in the timely dynamics of primordial emergence. And our next goal was to create a mathematical model that would not only reproduce the final dotted array of primordia, but also the whole timely dynamics of its emergence and interspecies differences between these dynamics. So we started with a fairly simple model. This is the reaction diffusion-like equations of Alan Turing combined with chemotaxis. This is quite classical. It was known to produce dotted arrays from initial random fluctuations, but not in a wave. So to try to intrinsically create this timely dynamics, we added to this initial conditions in a line so as to mimic the initial expression of beta catenin or the position of the first primordial rows. And so when we do this, we actually get stripes that will individualize in these dots, but not with the geometry that we observe in vivo. So the dots appear kind of randomly within the stripes. So to mimic this, the correct geometry, we added a logistic proliferation term. This is a mathematical term that is also used in a lot in population genetics and virology. And pretty much what it says is that the density of cells, N, will increase with the rate of proliferation alpha until it reaches a certain threshold beta above which proliferation stops. And so when we take this whole model and use it on initial conditions that are specific to each species, so meaning that the geometry really reproduces the geometry of beta catenin in each species, in this case, we were able to create a wave going from the medial part of the simulation to the lateral part of the simulation. And actually, when we compare this to the in vivo situation, the timely dynamics and the exact number of dots was exactly reproduced. And what was really fun was to modify these initial conditions such that they would resemble the other species, such as, for example, here the finch, and we would obtain a finch-like wave by doing this. And similarly, in the emu and the ostrich, if we simulate the wider beta-catenin area, we have no wave with dots arising simultaneously throughout the simulation frame. And the same was true for the gentoo pingu. So what this modeling work predicted is that primordia array arise through a self-organizing mechanism combined with logistic proliferation. And the species specificity is constrained by species-specific initial conditions. So from there, we actually went on to show that logistic proliferation is actually occurring in the skin. I don't have time to show you these results. I would refer you to this publication. And just quickly show you what we did to identify the nature of these species-specific initial conditions that constrain the outcome of self-organization. So again, we took advantage of this correlative power of natural variation, but this time we zoomed in the tract. So here you have a much closer view in each of these tracts. And we quantified different geometrical attributes of the pattern, such as the spacing, the size of primordia, and so on. And for today, we'll focus on the regularity in primordia arrangement, so pattern fidelity. We found actually a lot of differences between species. You can see that in emu and the ostrich, the pattern is fairly irregular. Regularity is intermediate in the chicken. It is much higher in the quail and the finch, and it's actually extreme. There is very high fidelity in the gentoo penguin. So we quantified this with a lot of different ways on which I'll skip. But then we were able to correlate this natural variation in pattern fidelity with differences in early cell properties in the skin. Actually, the early anisotropy of cells. So these would be views of the skin in each of these species at a stage where no primordia are present yet. And what we could see is that the higher the anisotropy of cells, so the oriented elongation along a certain axis, the higher the fidelity of the pattern. We could also observe some differences in orientation, on which I won't talk about today, but happy to answer questions afterwards. So at this point, we had a pretty nice correlation between the early amplitude of cell anisotropy and the fidelity of the pattern outcome. And we confirmed this link by doing functional tests. So in the lab, we're able to dissect out the skin of the embryo and culture it for a few days. We start when the skin is naive, and then we end up getting the actual primordia pattern. And we can do that in all the species. Here you have a cultured skin of an emu, here of a quail, and here of a gentoo penguin. And we can do that either in normal conditions or in the presence of a drug that will impair the acquisition of anisotropy. And when we did this, we actually observed and quantified a loss of pattern fidelity. So together, these experiments showed that early anisotropy amplitude is required for a high fidelity pattern. How does that work? To find out, we turned to a Japanese quail, and actually a transgenic strain of quail, transgenic for MGFP. And we, on explants, skin explants of these animals, we performed real-time imaging. So here again, you'll see a close-up view of the skin, developing skin of a Japanese quail. The cells become elongated along the anteroposterior axis. And then after the acquisition of, this is playing again, after the acquisition of this anisotropy, at some point, cells will aggregate locally to form a primordia here and actually here in this movie. So that's the control condition. And we did the same experiment in presence of that drug that impairs anisotropy. And so in this case, what you'll see is that cells actually do move more. Primordia still form, but they are displaced more along this axis. And sometimes they even fuse together, which is something that we would never observe in control conditions. And we actually analyzed these movies in depth. We performed a velocimetry analysis and so on, and were able to show that this early amplitude of anisotropy actually optimizes the motility of cells, which is what stabilizes the position of primordia and results in a high fidelity pattern. So here is a summary of this data. So that would be a scheme representing a bird without a head. That's the space competent to form a feather array. And within this competent space, in some species, cells are isotropic. So that's the case of the emu or the ostrich, or in an experiment where we impair anisotropy. If cells are isotropic, they are free to move. The primordia form through self-organization, but their position is rather loose, and we obtain a low pattern, a low fidelity pattern. If in some species anisotropy is higher, so in the penguin or the quail, this constrains the motility of cells, which stabilizes the position of primordia and results in a higher fidelity pattern. So in this case, we have identified early cell properties that actually constitute these species-specific initial conditions. And these properties are more or less anisotropy and optimal motility. So of course, now what we're trying to find out is what controls these species-specific initial condition. Is it arising through instruction? We have good reasons to think so. We also investigate the role of mechanical stress and material properties in the acquisition of these species-specific initial conditions. But I will stop here and thank the members of my lab, especially those who did the work. So here is Camille Curance. She did the work on pattern fidelity. She is now moved on to a postdoc at University of Galway. She's working on Hydra. And now here is Richard Bayeul. He was an applied mathematics student in the lab. He's now a postdoc at EMBL. He works on Sayuna. I seem to lose all my students to invertebrates. And so Richard did all the mathematical modeling work. Here are the people that we collaborate with. And with this, I just want to say happy birthday to Thomas. And thank you for your attention.